Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. I've been thinking a lot lately about connection and disconnection, and that's pretty big terrain. That's idea-wise, that spans a lot. And personally, I find it helpful to think about connection and disconnection as a continuum rather than as an either-or. And I find that helpful because in my experience, ideas kind of tend to swim around in contexts. They're not like bricks in a wall. They're more like fish in water, and they move around and behave differently. What I wrote in my notes was that think fish in water rather than sign beside the road. You know, like here it is posted. That's an idea. Nope, that's an idea. They're slippery. And so a continuum. So this connection and disconnection, if you want to think about this a little bit, we'll talk about it more in the weeks that are coming up, but think about them as poles on this continuum. And the general idea is that we can look at and experience pretty much anything in the world around us from a vantage point that starts with a different emphasis, right? We can kind of choose our emphasis as a starting point. We can emphasize as a starting point looking at anything in the world how everything in the world is connected to everything else. And if that's one pole on the continuum, at the other end of that continuum, we could choose to look at pretty much anything in the world as though it was its own thing, not connected to everything else. Surrounded by other things, but not necessarily connected. And we've seen, I mean, we're surrounded by examples of this. I won't even get into it at this point. We might come back to it. But in the world of belief, and maybe let's take religious belief for our context, for example, so we could say that we believe that God is love, and then we could hate our neighbor. To say that we believe that God is love and hate our neighbor requires disconnection as a context. If we start with the belief that everything's connected, then if I hate or harm someone else, I also hate or harm myself because we're connected. Right, so you could sort of see the ripples from that if we kind of take it at its extremities. And we'll do a whole exploration of that sometime, but because it's actually a huge piece of how we think about what we believe and how we live. For now, in this context, my own reading and musing about those ideas of connection and disconnection have led me to some questions about questions. And sometimes the things that we're exploring, including the things we explore here, seem so big and so unwieldy that it's hard to know where to start. Like, where do you actually enter this? So among the other things that have kind of gone through my mind in the last few weeks are things like, how can we not only explore what we believe, which is what we exist to do, but do so in ways that generate meaningful change in both what we believe and how we live out what we believe? Or to put it another way, how can we most helpfully or most productively, I feel ambivalent about the word productive. It's a very capitalist, mechanistic kind of word. It's a make things and sell them word. Helpfully might be a better word. How can we most helpfully question our beliefs so that our questioning process actually produces change? And that led me to the work of a person named Warren Berger, and in particular his work on asking what he calls more beautiful questions, which I thought was an intriguing combination of words about questions. So I was captivated right away by the book title, which includes that. I'll tell us about that in a moment. So many of the particulars of this exploration and some of the subsequent ones are drawn from Berger's thinking about asking better questions. So for a bit of both context and credit where it's due, Berger is a journalist. That's his profession. And he wrote a book a while ago now, probably about a decade ago, I think. And the book title was A More Beautiful Question, The Power of Inquiry to Spark Breakthrough Ideas. And he wasn't planning to write that book. He was part of a larger project where he was researching the work of people whose thinking has produced meaningful innovations or breakthroughs. So he just kind of had this big project that he was working on where he was interviewing folks whose work had had these kinds of impact. And as a journalist, as a curious, exploring professional, he started to realize that there were some themes in those people's work, even though the arenas in which they worked varied wildly. And the further he got into it, the more he realized that many of those people had something in common, which was the way they approached asking questions. And why that was so critical in an area, or rather in an era where we're saturated both with information and with information that is often in conflict with other information, and we're saturated in an environment where information is constantly and rapidly becoming obsolete. It's like, that's what we knew about that 2 years ago, now we know this. So you thought you were an expert, well, good luck keeping up, right? And we're surrounded by that, and we have access to so much of it. Now, all of what we're about to consider could be seen from a purely sort of business perspective, and in Berger's original book, he certainly offers that point of view. That is a perspective that tends to value action and application, right? Outcomes. That's what you measure in business. If you can't measure it, you can't manage it, is what one of my mentors would have said. Right, so that's a particular perspective. So before we get into this, I think it might be worth a little quick little detour to ask, what does all of this have to do with exploring what we believe? As distinct from how do we build a more profitable business, let's say, or motivate our team to higher performance, or whatever our business question is. Now, what we're on about here. And it's intriguing to me that Berger addresses this pretty directly, and he puts it this way, quote, "We are all hungry for better answers. But first, we need to learn how to ask the right questions." And that first part, we're all hungry for better answers, that really resonated with me. I mean, if we're exploring what we believe, to me, it's not necessarily true for everybody in the community, I realize, but to me, it's implicit in exploring what you believe that you're not satisfied with the answers you've got. Otherwise, why go exploring, arguably, right? We're exploring because there's something that we're not settled about, or because there's new information coming in, or because our perspective is changing, or because we have an experience that means that what we used to believe doesn't work for us anymore. But in any case, we're after a better answer to some degree. So I was like, yep, that makes sense. When I think about why we explore what we believe, and I think about my work in this context, the reasons I've heard people give over the years for why they're reconsidering, leaving, deconstructing, exploding, whatever we want to choose to call it, what I often hear from people is about that. They have a hunger for a better answer. Because lots of us have been taught to think like in binaries. Many of those conversations have been about saying, I had this answer and I want a better answer that'll behave just like a this answer, right? I want a new static answer. And what we're going to explore kind of doesn't fit great with that, because Berger's take on beautiful questions, as we'll see, is very dynamic. So it's not about finding a better set of answers that we can then be dogmatic about. It's actually about learning how to constantly ask better questions. So it's about being evolving as opposed to being evolved, if that makes any sense. We'll unpack it a bit more. In those conversations with people over the years, that hunger for a better answer kind of has a couple of features. Sometimes it's stirred in with hope that there is a better answer. Sometimes it's mixed with the notion that there isn't one answer, but many answers. It's more of a process of sifting and sorting. Sometimes it's tinged with the despair or resignation or the challenge of living well in a world where the person has come to believe there are no better answers, and so on. There's quite a range in my experience. But most often, exploring what we believe comes with some sense of we could do better, or we need to do better, or I think this part works okay, but that part is busted and needs some attention. You know, those kinds of, more of those kind of things. What if, and we'll see as we go that what if is a really important shape of question, what if Berger is onto something when he suggests that the more helpful order in which to consider change of any sort is first of all to learn how to ask the right or better questions? What if that's a better order of business, if you will? if we're serious about exploring what we believe, and we think the outcome of that sort of endeavor might be worth the effort, doesn't it make sense that we would want to pursue it in as effective a way as possible? Like, why? Unless we're just really looking for a way to kill some time. So that's the first reason that I think this matters in our context. We're motivated to improve what we believe, to find a better belief, a better answer in our context. The second is related to that. For good or for ill, I'm a bit philosophically inclined. I find ideas both interesting and quite satisfying in themselves. And to some degree, that's because I'm also, as a type, fairly intuitive, which means that I find it easy to imagine the implications of ideas. Doesn't mean I always imagine them well, but I find it easy to imagine them. However, as important as ideas are not actions. And the same thing is true of questions. Without action, questions remain philosophical at best. They stay in the realm of ideas, and they don't turn into actual change, or to use Berger's preferred term, they don't turn into innovation. They stay in the realm of ideas. Beautiful questions, as he calls them, he suggests beautiful questions are questions that are ambitious but actionable. They're the sorts of questions that catalyze change by helping us see and think differently and that innovate or motivate action. So for Berger, a beautiful question is one you can do something about. You can turn it into action. That's part of what makes it beautiful, is that it actually produces meaningful change. It's not just, air quotes around just, but it's not just inquiry, right? It's inquiry that leads to innovation or change. So from my perspective, here's one core truth about action that matters in this context. Generally speaking, you can disagree, of course, as always, but I certainly deeply believe, and generally speaking, the realm of psychology would affirm this, we act out what we believe. Our actions come from our beliefs. And if or when we act in ways that aren't consistent with what we believe, and this isn't always a conscious process, our subconscious is heavily involved in this, we may well experience the symptoms of misalignment, of feeling like something's off, so or that what we think and what we're doing doesn't match up, and that bugs us. Actually, I would say that bugs us is the mild version of the symptoms. When we're experiencing this, we might feel exhausted, depressed, we might wrestle with a potentially wide variety of mental health challenges. All of these can follow in the wake of not living in a way that's true to what we believe. Like, this really matters to our human experience. All to say, we tend to feel most whole and most well as persons, most healthy might be a better word, as persons, when we live what we believe. There are all kinds of challenges to that, of course. So, when we go exploring what we believe, and we find that there are things we wish or need to change, it's rather important to do that in a way that also produces changes in our actions. Is this tracking so far? If that's true, if changes in what we believe also produce changes in our actions, the alignment between what we believe and how we're living can sort of track along together. Now, I wish I could tell you that this process is always super tidy and that the timelines between changing what we believe and how we act are short and efficient. And they are not. Sometimes that happens. But more often, this is a bit messy and it's a bit protracted, not least of all because it can take a while to both sort out a change in what we believe. That can take, decades, right? Like, that can be a life-size project. And on the other side of the coin, sometimes it can happen fairly quickly, but it can take a while to sort out what we change, a change in what we believe. And then it can also take a bit of experimenting, what Berger calls innovating, to figure out what that change in belief looks like in how we act. So the implications of a changed belief in our actions can take a while to, we can be like, well, if I change this about what I believe, what does it have to do with how I live? Well, maybe it means I need to change this about how I live. And we change that, and it's like, no, not quite. And we try, so it takes a bit of experimenting sometimes to get this to settle down, if you will, into a way that feels like, there we go. Now those things are playing well together. As we've often considered in this space, it's not unusual for these kinds of changes to also involve our relationships with other people, which can add complexity and time to the process, right? we might change something about what we believe and see that the implications of that in our actions are considerable. We need to change this about our actions. And then we start to consider our context, our wider relational or occupational or familial or just general social context. And we realize, oh, if I change this, it's going to impact this person this way. Can I still make that change? Do I still wish to make that change? Am I able? And so, like, right? So it can get incredibly complicated, of course. So I don't want to blow any sunshine at us about that. Having said that, as I mentioned before, and I will surely mention again, I don't believe that complexity is something to shy away from. In fact, if we're interested in living, so back to that connected-disconnected idea, if we're interested in living more connected lives, complexity is a given. It's even a necessity. This is an aside, but one of the reasons people that favor more disconnected worldviews do so is because it can make it feel easier to ignore the implications of our ideas and choices and actions for everyone and everything around us. We can make a choice and actually believe this has nothing to do with anybody else. Because we're not connected to them in our overall view of the world, right? This is one of the reasons we get away collectively. I'll use a benign as a shared example. This is one of the reasons why we are part of such an incredibly wasteful, materially wasteful society. Because we actually have, many of us, have never thought about the material fact that every material thing goes somewhere. Nowhere goes, nothing goes nowhere. Like, garbage is real. Right? But if we live in a disconnected world, we can be just like, that goes in the garbage. It's gone, right? But it's never gone. So just as a kind of a concrete everyday, but that's a challenge, isn't it? Because you buy food in the grocery store and it comes in a package, and what do you do about, right? So you can see how just in an ordinary, everyday, consumable kind of way, this stuff gets complicated really fast. So if any of these ideas, I was thinking about this as I was writing this, I was thinking, these ideas judge me. Like, I feel measured by them. That's good. That's what a good idea should do, to challenge me. I also have the opportunity to share them in community, which means other people might feel judged by these ideas. And our human inclination is to kind of go, the person who's sharing these ideas is judging me. I want to say as clearly as I can, like, as far as I'm concerned, we're all swimming in this lake together. I'm not coming at any of this as any sort of expert. I come at this fully as an explorer and a full-blown bumbler. Like, this stuff is hard to figure out. But it's also quite intriguing because of the possibilities. So in that spirit, back to beautiful questions. What I'm going to do with the balance of this particular talky bit is outline in sort of fairly pragmatic terms some important background questions about questions, and then the next time we explore, we'll actually get to the point where we consider two other things. One is, why do we stop asking questions? Because as kids we ask questions, and then we get trained out of it, and there's reasons for that. And then what's an actual simple, memorable method for trying to imagine a beautiful question? So we actually end up asking beautiful questions. So that's where we're headed. All right. So first of all, why ask questions at all? Like, why bother? Because it gets us into all kinds of trouble potentially, right? Here's the first reason. I've touched on it already, but I want to unpack it a little bit. We all know that we're awash in information, right? We can always, you know, I think several times in the last few months I've seen a person of about my age walking around in some public place wearing a t-shirt that says, I don't need Google because my wife knows everything. And we kind of get the joke, right? But the notion that Google knows everything is what underpins that slogan. We have access to just limitless information, right? And as handy as it is to say, just Google it, having access to endless information is hard on us as humans. And for all that tech and access to it can be tremendously helpful in solving some sorts of problems, particularly sorting problems, right? So there's, like, if we want to get into the weeds of AI, the ability of that kind of computing to sift through massive amounts of data and see possible connections between data far surpasses our human ability to do that. But it can help us answer profoundly important human questions about health, for example, right? So there's all of that good potential there. Having said that, it's not, access to that is not demonstrably making us healthier, happier, or just generally better human beings. Like, if you look around the world in general, that doesn't seem to be what's generally coming from that. In fact, it's pretty easy to make a case for how access to endless information, and this is the caveat, and it's really important, access to endless information without a way to sift and sort and prioritize that info is being pretty hard on us overall. And it's that sifting and sorting and prioritizing process that is pinned to asking good questions. Right? The skill set of querying all that information, that's profoundly human. And it's a skill set. We can learn it. We can get better at it. So that's sort of what we're talking about. And not by the way, all of this is just as true about things we might call beliefs as it is about any other category of information. We are awash in access to information about beliefs in a way that it was unimaginable a few decades ago. Want to know how to be a casual Buddhist? I mean, just put in the search criteria, how do you be a casual Buddhist, and you'll be swimming in it, right? Like, that was impossible a little while ago. So, when it comes to beliefs, same thing applies. That doesn't necessarily make us better at practicing what we believe, does it? It just means we have access to information about beliefs. And this is where good questions come in. Good questions provide us with the ability to contextualize and to examine what is in front of us from different angles. But I remember the first time I realized in a particular clear sort of way, I think I'd experienced it before, but I didn't have language for it, that my way of thinking was particular. That it wasn't human, it wasn't not human, but it wasn't human in the general sense of all humans think like this. It was Western. It was empirical. It was centered reason. Like it had features that were particular, and that other humans thought in ways that had different features that didn't work like that. And the moment where that landed for me was actually when somebody told me this story, in this case a story from India in terms of broader cultural context, about a bunch of blindfolded people who are put in a space with an elephant, and we've heard the story, right? And asked to tell the listener, to describe it, right? And so one describes, like, it's a tree trunk, and it's got, you know, another one's like, it's like a long tapering tube, and they're describing the whole elephant, but one's a tusk and a leg and a foot and a ear and a, right, the trunk, and so all these different perspectives. None of them were the elephant, and if we wanted a description of the elephant, we needed all these different perspectives. And I realized, oh, that's not the way I was taught to think. Big right? And for me, those are what led me to, like, this, to the table, among other things, to valuing exploration and other perspectives. I'm not saying I'm good at it, but it has changed profoundly for me over the years. Good questions can help us contextualize and examine what is in front of us from different angles. To actually consciously, deliberately ask, oh, can you tell me more about the tree trunk? Because that's not the experience I'm having. Can you tell me more about the thing that feels like a big floppy sail? Because that's not the experience I'm having. Because I want to get a better picture of the elephant, you know? Right? So let me ask you some questions. Verger puts it this way. In such times, times of constant change, is what he's describing. In such times, the ability to ask big, meaningful, beautiful questions can be the first step and moving beyond old habits and behaviors as we embrace the new. But we need some kind of filter. We need some way to process this. Asking good questions is an ability, it's a skill set, and it can help us decide what to believe and how to enact that belief, whether that's about something that pops up in the sidebar of something or something that an authority on what to believe has to say. You know, like all the way across the range, right? It doesn't just have to come from a suspect source. Can come from a trusted source. All right, so that's one reason. Another important reason to ask good questions is that questions frame our thoughts, and our thoughts outline and deeply influence our actions and our feelings. This is an entirely additional conversation, but I feel like I should mention that this is true not only of our deliberate planned out actions, but also of our reactions, okay, which are also actions. They're just sourced a little differently. If we want to change how we react to something, step one is often to question and change our thinking about that something. If we change our thoughts about it, that will influence our experience of it. And some of us have been taught to think that that's not true, that the experience is what it is. That's only true materially. That's not true in our experience. The fact of what happens I'll give you a quote that kind of pulls this together here in a moment. But the fact of what happens materially has relatively little to do with what we make of it. We're constantly interpreting what's happening to, in, and around us. Viktor Frankl, best known as the author of Man's Search for Meaning, a Holocaust survivor, a polymath, a really brilliant person in many different disciplines, put it this way. He writes, in Man's Search for Meaning, he writes this, between stimulus, which is what's happening around, in, and to us, between stimulus and response, what we do, there is a space. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response, it's implicit here, in our chosen response, lies our growth and our freedom. I would pay attention to that anywhere I found it, but I feel like I am uniquely inclined to pay attention to it in Holocaust survivor. And their lived wisdom, right? Somebody who's been so thoroughly disempowered structurally, saying between stimulus, being put in a work camp, and response, there's a space. And in that space, I get to make a choice about my response. And that's my freedom. That's a powerful idea. To put it into other words, in our context, we can learn to question what we're experiencing and feeling before we act. This is a whole other conversation, but feelings are information. Feelings are not directives. And good questions can help us decode the information that our feelings are trying to send us. Like I said, whole additional conversation, but I thought we're stirring into the mix. All right, a couple of other things quickly here, and then we'll wrap up. Questions don't just frame our thoughts. They also help us expand and focus our thinking. So, for example, asking speculative questions. Let me give you an example. Like, a speculative question would be, why is punishment effective? Why is punishment effective is the kind of question that might help us think bigger about punishment and its implications for humans as a method of correction, let's say. Okay? So that's an expanding question. Speculative. And when we ask expanding questions, so, for example, on that one, we might back up even further in the process, and we might find ourselves asking a question like, why might someone believe that punishment is effective? And then we might bookend a question like that with, why might someone believe that punishment is not effective? Right? So you can see, like, this is a funnel. It's going this way. Like, it's getting bigger. Right? Speculative questions expand what we're exploring. They're not the only valuable questions. They're a great place to start. But you can sort of see how that kind of inquiry is prone to expansion. Each of those lines of inquiry that I just mentioned could readily take us into bigger and bigger questions about worldviews and human nature and contextual understanding of justice and social health. And right, it just can go like this. On the other side of good questions, we have what are called closed or convergent questions. And those kind of questions can help us to direct our focus or focus our thinking to find consensus or to find a specific answer. So to use our previous example of those were open or expanding questions, right? An example of a closed question about that same topic might be something like, is punishment effective? So basically, if we're trying to figure out what kind of question is which, especially in the early going of developing these skills, it can be helpful to remember that a closed question can generally be fully answered with yes or no. So if a question can be answered yes or no, it's a closed question. Closed sounds negative, but what it means is focused on a yes or no, on particularities. And an expanding or open question cannot be answered that way. So as categories, those are important ones. And beyond that, the tone of our questions can really affect the outcome, right? So we see what we're looking for as humans. So the tone with which we inquire about something can have a profound effect on what sorts of answers. So for example, a question like, say we're experiencing a difficult circumstance, we could ask a question like, how can we possibly survive this? And that can have a very different effect on us, that line of inquiry can have a very different effect on us than a question like, how can we make the most of this situation? Same situation, right? And if you find yourself intuitively shying away from that second question because there's a little or maybe not so little voice in your head saying something like, that's avoiding reality, like asking how can we make the most of this situation, that's being Pollyanna-ish. That's trying to my mom might have said silk purse a sow's ear, like trying to turn something awful into something good, like you're ignoring the awful. Not the case. Neither one of those questions avoids reality at all. They're both querying the same reality. Neither one is asking how can we avoid facing this, but they are asking different questions about how we might face this. Does that make sense? Right? So we're not trying to end run the difficulty when we ask how can we make the best of this at all. The difference is that those two questions invite us to look at it from different angles. Elephants, blindfolds, right? And because we tend to see what we're looking for as human beings, this is one of the way our brains help us survive, is they filter out the things that we're not looking for, because we couldn't handle it if we were looking at everything at the same time. The second inquiry, how can we make the best of this, is likely to lead us in very different directions than the first, which is how can we survive this? They're both valid questions, but they're going to produce really different outcomes. One of the things that we enjoy doing as a couple and as a family is riding our bicycles in the woods, in the mountains, and on sometimes challenging trails. Some of those trails go uphill quite a lot, and some of them were bumpy and going uphill, which makes them harder. And so in recent experience of this, I was thinking, what happens if I imagine, this will sound a little loopy maybe, but just stay with me. What happens if I imagine that on this difficult climb, there's a rope connected to the front of my bicycle, and it's towing me uphill? Like, it's just tight enough to give me a little bit of a tow. There's no rope. Okay, this is completely in my head. It is now a consistent part of my hill climbing technique because it felt different to climb when I imagined the tow rope. There's no tow rope. I'm not delusional about this. It's the same effort materially. But psychologically, it felt really different. And I climbed better. I still can't catch green. But I climbed better. You know, like it really made a lived different experience. And to me, that was like, huh, I know I say this stuff actually works this way. I better experiment with it, right? Do I really believe this? I should try it. Huh, how about that? It actually does work this way. So this is very powerful stuff, what's going on in our heads, which is why there are people out there who make their living as sports psychologists and so on, right? All right, one more and then we're going to say that's enough for today. The right questions, when followed through with action, can lead to innovation and change. There's sort of the tidy equation. A couple of real-world examples, just really short ones, from the wider world. 1950s, somebody asked the question, business question, what if we could paper over our mistakes? When I read this little history example, I was like, that's a beautiful question. Like, who of us has not had done something where we're like, oh, I'd like to just paper over that, right? At least as a metaphor. That question led to the invention of liquid paper. Like, that question actually led somebody to go, what if we took that question literally? What if we could actually paper over our typing errors? And this is before you could just hit, you know, undo, right? This is a physical thing. So that, as an example. The question, why aren't players urinating more after games? We were talking about heat exhaustion earlier, right? And I've been drinking liters and stuff. Why is this happening? That led to the invention of the sports drink Gatorade. The question was not, how can we invent a sports drink and sell millions of bottles of it? The question was, what's going on physiologically with these athletes? And the subsequent questions led to this response, right? So that's kind of the way the process works in very brief. We haven't said anything about this specifically, but perhaps you've gotten the sense, I've touched on it, about just how open-ended this process of good questions can be, and in many ways that's intentional. It is a movement, a deliberate movement, away from either-or thinking toward actual enacted change. It's a process that is intended to keep unfolding, question leading to question, until we find ourselves able to focus on, I can or I will change this aspect of what I believe, or I can or I will live differently as a result of this different perspective. And so as we move through the expanding questions, we start to choose, we'll talk about this in the method, but we start to choose particular points in that expanding set of information, that filter that we're using, and go, what if I focused on this one, right? What would change in my life in a particular way? So actual change, not just philosophical change. We're going to leave it there for now, but when we come back to it, we'll start by considering why we might have moved away from questioning as children, like I said before, to being less questioning or less curious as adults, and then to a simple sort of method or guide for asking beautiful questions about what we believe. So that's where we headed. peace.